It is 5 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
UN officials meet with South Sudanese rebel leader Riek Machar. UN Security Council lifts diamond export ban on Ivory Coast. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon Tuesday urged South Sudanese President Salva Kiir to call for an end to what Mr. Ban calls a negative campaign against UN peacekeepers and bring to justice those responsible for attacks on civilians and UN staff. In a phone call, the UN chief urged Mr. Kiir to halt, quote, the vicious fighting and appalling killing of South Sudanese civilians. The UN aid chief in South Sudan, Toby Lanzer, Tuesday called for a month-long truce, warning that millions face hunger if the four-month conflict continues. Meanwhile, two UN officials held talks with South Sudanese leaders in the conflict, human rights official Navi Pillay and Adama Diang, the UN Special Advisor on Prevention of Genocide, met Tuesday with Riek Machar, former vice president who leads rebel forces.
We had a good meeting of about 35 minutes and gave him the concerns of the Secretary General about protection of civilians. And we received assurances from him that he himself is investigating the human rights violations that occurred in Bientou, and that he is also concerned about protection of civilians here.
The United Nations has accused rebels of hunting down hundreds of people in a hospital, church, and mosque in Bientou April 15th, killing them based on their ethnicity and nationality. The UN Refugee Agency says it's racing to provide essential supplies for hundreds of thousands of South Sudanese displaced by the fighting. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
UNHCR spokeswoman Fatoumata Lejeune Kaba describes conditions in most of these sites as appalling. She says they lack water and sanitation. She blames the terrible conditions on underfunding and lack of security.
It's not everywhere that we can access all the time. The lines of fighting move constantly. The displaced themselves move constantly. So even if they receive assistance in one place and they are forced again to flee because of new fighting.
Lejeune Kaba says the UNHCR is airlifting more relief supplies from Dubai to the capital Juba for 100,000 displaced people. She says the blankets, sleeping mats, water buckets, and other relief items will be distributed mainly in Unity, Upper Nile, and Jonglei states. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The UN Security Council has lifted a ban on diamond exports from Ivory Coast and moved to ease an arms embargo on the West African nation. The Council Tuesday adopted a resolution lifting the diamond embargo put in place in 2005 during the country's civil war. The embargo lifted so Ivorian security forces can acquire small-caliber weapons. Ivorian UN Ambassador Youssef Obamba, speaking through an interpreter, hailed the vote. He said the world body recognizes his country has fully satisfied minimum conditions of the Kimberley process, the system to ensure so-called conflict diamonds don't enter the world market.
The resolution recognizes the urgent necessity for the government of Cote d'Ivoire to train and equip its security forces, especially the police and gendarmerie, with significant weapons and ammunition to carry out their security missions and peace maintaining order.
The 2002 civil war in Ivory Coast split the country in two. Former President Laurent Gbagbo was ousted by force after losing a 2010 election. The UN Security Council unanimously voted Tuesday to keep a UN peacekeeping force in Western Sahara for another year, but without a mandate to monitor human rights, which was supported by UN Chief Ban Ki-moon but opposed by the King of Morocco. Morocco annexed the territory in the 1970s and fought a local independence movement called the Polisario Front. The world body brokered a ceasefire in 1991. Referendum on the territory's future has never taken place. Morocco has proposed autonomy for Western Sahara, but the Polisario Front insists on self-determination. Mali's new Prime Minister Moussa Mara, addressing Parliament Tuesday, pledged to revive peace talks over the country's troubled north. He said his government would invite armed groups and, quote, legitimate representatives of the north, so any agreement that has the best possible chance of being concluded. Angola's President José Eduardo dos Santos met Tuesday with his French counterpart, François Hollande, in France during a rare official visit. Ties were strained during a scandal dubbed Angolagate involving French politicians and accusations of bribe-taking leveled at Mr. dos Santos in the 1990s. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News. More on the internet at voanews.com.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, April 30th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry leaves for Africa today with a message for South Sudan leaders.
The leaders need to step up here and open up to creating a civil society, open up to government reforms, open up to dialogue, open up to inclusivity.
That's U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry. The four South Sudanese officials recently released from prison say they are ready to help resolve the country's conflict. U.S. Secretary of State Kerry has met with his Egyptian counterpart in Washington, and the United Nations says Egypt's mass death sentences breach international law.
You don't have to be an international lawyer to realize that this is the fundamental basis of a fair trial for you to know what you are being tried for.
Ravina Shamdasani is spokesperson for the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. We will look at the role of immigrant pressures on the disintegration of some Somali families and changing the penal code that makes abortion a crime in Senegal. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our Listener of the Day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry begins a three-nation Africa tour today, Wednesday, for talks on violence in South Sudan and the Central African Republic. VOA State Department correspondent Scott Stearns has the story.
A senior State Department official traveling with Secretary Kerry says the top U.S. diplomat will be delivering tough messages to both sides in South Sudan that they'll be held accountable if they don't take the necessary actions to end the hostilities. The United States has in place a mechanism for a travel ban and assets freeze on individuals responsible for violence that followed allegations of a December coup attempt. Secretary Kerry says President Barack Obama is now looking very closely at imposing those sanctions.
We're going to continue to push, but it may be that sanctions are one of the things that have to take impact. We're evaluating that now.
In Addis Ababa, Kerry will meet with his counterparts from Ethiopia, Uganda, and Kenya in hopes of getting them to join economic sanctions and a travel ban. A senior administration official says South Sudanese President Salva Kiir and his former vice president, now rival Riek Machar, both appear to believe they can win militarily, and neither have the country's best good in their hearts. Secretary Kerry will be briefed on the violence by former Nigerian leader Olusegun Obasanjo, who heads an African Union Commission of Inquiry. At the AU, Kerry will meet with officials on peacekeeping efforts in the Central African Republic, where he says it's regrettable that China joined Russia in blocking United Nations sanctions.
Without the UN sanction, it becomes much more difficult to be able to take the steps that we think are necessary.
On this trip, Kerry will also meet with Somali President Hassan Sheikh Mohamed to discuss the fight against the Al-Qaeda-linked Al-Shabaab militia. He'll travel to Kinshasa to meet with President Joseph Kabila about security in eastern Congo, where a senior State Department official says there's some success after many, many years of conflict. Those talks will include amnesty for some M23 rebels, as well as Congolese judicial accountability for some of their leaders. Secretary Kerry also will visit Angola for talks with President José Eduardo dos Santos, who a senior State Department official says has played an extraordinarily positive role in helping resolve crises in both the Democratic Republic of Congo and the Central African Republic. Kerry will meet with civil society and business leaders in Ethiopia and Angola. There's a microfinance event in Congo, as well as a meeting with UN Special Representative Martin Kobler. Scott Stearns, VOA News at the State Department.
The recently released detainees accused of plotting to overthrow South Sudanese President Salva Kiir say they are ready to meet with both President Kiir and former Vice President Riek Machar to help resolve the crisis. Ezekiel Lo Gatkuof is one of the released detainees and a former liaison officer at the South Sudanese Embassy to the United States. He says the government in Juba seized their travel documents, preventing them from traveling abroad to seek medical checkups. He also denies that the group plotted to overthrow the government in Juba. Gatkuof tells reporter Peter Clotty that the released detainees want to help resolve the ongoing conflict.
Actually, in the first place, there was no case. Of course, I'm innocent. I did not commit any crime. I did not even believe that there was a coup from the beginning. Of course, the case was collapsing right in front of our eyes because the prosecution presented it in court, and the court was actually about to acquit us. And this is when the government intervened and stayed the proceedings. So four of us, we are out, and the mission now first is to make sure that there is peace in this country. This is our number one priority. We need to cease the hostilities and have a permanent ceasefire so that the guns must be silenced. And basically our agenda is for us to bring this country together.
When do you plan meeting President Salva Kiir, Dr. Riek Machar, and the rest of the seven who were released earlier?
We are ready to meet them anytime. From tomorrow, we are available. We will meet the president anytime he wants us to meet him. And then from there, we can see how best we can go to meet Dr. Riek Machar, tell you where he is. And then the message is peace. I'm sure all of them, they are for peace. That's why there is a negotiation in Addis. And we are all for peace.
We were informed that some of you decided you wanted to go to Kenya and Ethiopia to join the peace talks, but you were prevented from going because your documents were confiscated. The government is saying that the president wanted you to stay in the country to work for peace instead of going outside the country to bring in a third party, which they believe could undermine efforts to reconcile the country or bring peace to the country. What is your stance on that?
The reason why we were trying to go to Nairobi is we have been in detention for almost 5 months now. We were trying to go to Nairobi for medical checkups. Nobody is actually trying to leave the country. So being in the country or traveling outside the country will not prevent us from bringing peace to this country. We are also appealing to the government. They should not take this as if we are trying to go away from the country and we will not come back and we will complicate the process. Nobody will complicate this process because this is our will. We are committed to peace. And South Sudanese as a whole, even if you ask anybody in South Sudan, they are for peace. There is nobody who can go against the will of the people.
Ezekiel Lo Gatkuov is one of the released officials accused of plotting to overthrow the South Sudanese government. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from South Sudan's capital, Juba. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and his Egyptian counterpart, Nabil Fahmy, met in Washington Tuesday. They discussed an Egyptian court's decision Monday to sentence 683 supporters of the outlawed Muslim Brotherhood to death for their role in protests last year against the overthrow of former President Mohamed Morsi. Ken Brademeyer reports.
United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon voiced his alarm over the death sentences handed down by the Egyptian court. Amnesty International said the Egyptian judiciary risked becoming what it described as just another part of the authorities' repressive machinery. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, as he headed into a meeting with Egyptian Foreign Minister Nabil Fahmy, said Egypt is clearly going through a very difficult transitional process in the weeks leading up to next month's presidential election. The top American diplomat said Egypt's constitution is a positive step forward, but called the mass death sentences a disturbing development.
But even as these positive steps have been taken, we all know there have been disturbing decisions within the judicial process, the court system, that have raised serious challenges for all of us.
It is the second time a court in Minya, Egypt, has handed down mass death sentences after very short judicial hearings, although most of the 529 sentences imposed in March have been commuted to life imprisonment. Egypt's foreign minister said the country's courts are independent of the government, but part of what Egypt is all about.
I can't comment on the content of the decisions themselves, but I'm confident that due process is allowed, and appeal process is allowed, and that the legal system will ultimately end up with the proper decisions in each of these cases. And we will build a democracy based on the rule of law.
One Middle Eastern affairs analyst, Robert Hazan of Metropolitan State University of Denver, said he is skeptical of the prospects for fairness. He called the sentences a serious breach of basic fundamentals, principles of a reasonable judiciary process.
We don't understand the rationale of that. We don't understand whether these are reasonable judgments.
The U.S. is considering further aid to Cairo, but Hazan said that while the U.S. can condemn the sentences occurring inside one of its staunchest allies in the Middle East, It cannot let anything happen that would push Egypt into anarchy and chaos. Ken Breitemeyer, VOA News, Washington.
Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights is also strongly condemning Egypt's mass imposition of the death penalty on 683 individuals. Navi Pillay calls the mass trials shocking, outrageous, and a breach of international human rights law to which Egypt is a party. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Monday's death sentence for 683 individuals is the second time in 2 months Egypt's criminal court in Al-Minya, a town south of Cairo, has imposed this harsh penalty on huge groups of defendants after perfunctory trials. In March, the same court sentenced to death 529 supporters of ousted Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi on the charge of having killed a policeman. They were convicted after only 2 court sessions. UN Human Rights Chief Navi Pillay accuses Egypt of trampling international fair trial guarantees and ignoring worldwide pleas to respect its human rights obligations. Her spokeswoman, Ravina Shamdasani, says most of the 683 defendants were tried in absentia without access to lawyers. She says the defense did not have the opportunity to cross-examine witnesses.
Most of them were tried without even being in custody. And when the sentence was handed down, they were not present in court. Some of them may be at large. Some of them may have left the country. The reports that are coming out are very conflicting. In fact, one report suggests that one of the individuals who was sentenced to death is actually already dead.
Under Egyptian law, the Grand Mufti reviews death sentences, but the religious leader's opinion is non-binding on the presiding judge. The Grand Mufti recommended the death sentences for the first group of 529 people be commuted. And on Monday, the judge upheld the death penalty for 37 defendants while reducing the sentences of the others to 25 years. Shamdasani says in both mass trials, the charges were not read, so defendants do not know what laws they were accused of breaking.
You don't have to be an international lawyer to realize that this is the fundamental basis of a fair trial for you to know what you are being tried for. We've received just a list of charges which relate to the killing of one policeman, the torching of a police station, and other incitement to violence, vandalism, unlawful gathering, and membership of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Shamdasani notes membership in an unlawful organization is certainly not grounds for the death penalty. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The story of the Somali-American teenager who survived 5 hours in the wheel well of a jetliner flying from California to Hawaii has drawn intense coverage in the international media. But for some Somali communities in the United States and elsewhere, the story is a reminder of the challenges facing families who fled war in Somalia only to struggle with huge cultural adjustments to their new home. VOA's Pam Dawkins tells us more in this report prepared by Mohamed Ola Hassan.
Medical experts say Yahya Abdi was very lucky to survive the thin air and sub-zero temperatures he encountered while tucked inside the wheel well of a jet flying at more than 11,000 meters. One of the questions that immediately rose after this harrowing incident was what could force a teenager like Yahya to risk his life. In separate interviews with VOA, both Yahya's father and mother said extreme homesickness could have been the reason. According to law enforcement officials, the teen had argued with his father's family in California and was trying to reach Somalia to see his mother. Abdinur Sheikh Mohammed is an education consultant with Ohio State University. Speaking in Somali, he says, the family structure was broken in general by the process of looking for a second home. Refugees in general go through these difficulties in bringing all these families together. In the U.S., we have a family reunification process where family members who scattered across the world can be brought together in the U.S., even though it takes a long process. Hashi Shafi, executive director of the Minneapolis-based organization Somali Action Alliance, says Yahya is not alone in missing family members left behind in Somalia.
Young kid now was one of the examples, but really it's not only him. But I know many young kids in Minnesota who have been struggling lately. And some of them, when you engage them in conversation, they tell you up front, I'm really missing my mom, who I have not seen her for 15 years or 10 years.
More than two decades of lawlessness and civil war has forced hundreds of thousands of Somalis to leave the country. Most of them say either they would have been caught in the crossfire or starved to death if they had stayed at home. The ones coming to the U.S. have largely settled in the city of Minneapolis. While Americans have mostly welcomed the immigrants, the Somalis have faced difficulties with language and a radically different culture. Abdi Salam Sharif Adam, an English as a second language teacher in Minneapolis, says family disintegration is to blame for some other major problems existing within the Somali American community.
We do notice that many families do not have the entire family together. So there's a gap in that area that we really feel. The issue of identity of who am I? Am I Somali? Am I Muslim? Am I American? That question is unclear to many of the students, and they get different messages, conflicting messages from their elders.
16-year-old Yahya Abdi felt that pain and took that risk when he stowed away on the flight last Sunday. His survival will bring him a certain notoriety, but it does not reunite his family. I'm Pam Dawkins for Mohammed Olad Hassan for VOA News, Washington.
A task force of women's rights workers in Senegal is pushing to change the country's penal code, which makes abortion a crime punishable by up to 3 years in jail for the mother and 5 years for a physician who administers an abortion. The group is hoping to make abortion legal in cases of rape, incest, or health risks to the mother or fetus. Fatou Camara, an associate professor of law at Senegal's Cheikh Anta Diop University, tells Ricky Shryak that Senegal's current penal code goes against the country's own constitution.
It puts upon the state the obligation, the duty, to make available for women and girls who are pregnant safe abortion in case of rape, incest, or when the mental health or the physical health of the woman is at risk, or when her life or the life of the fetus is at risk. So our point is, it's already inside the Senegalese legal system that the women have those rights. So it's not at all acceptable that women should go to jail because they have exercised that right that their state and their national assembly has given them. So all we're asking is that this discrepancy between the law and the convention, which is inside our constitution, should be taken care of.
In an interview the other day, you spoke about a 9-year-old girl who was raped and became pregnant. Can you tell me a little bit about the cases you've seen in cases of rape, what these women have to do, what are their choices?
The choices the women have are this. If there are women who are rich women, they have means, or they have a husband or a boyfriend who can pay for the procedure, then they will just stay. And according to Senegalese standard, the price is quite high. At least you have to pay 200,000 TFA, which is a lot of money here. So it's only women with means who can afford safe abortion. But if you're a poor woman, a woman who lives in rural areas, or a young girl with no support, you have either to go through with an unwanted pregnancy, and then you kill the baby, the newborn baby, or you try to get abortion in unsafe conditions and you either die or you get infections. You can go out of it being disabled. And it's important to know that we have a lot of minors, 10, 9 years old, 11 years old, I mean, really minors who are raped and who are forced to go on with unwanted pregnancy. And some of them die. Some of them, there was this young girl, 15 years old, they go to jail after they went through abortion and they nearly died. And then the police comes to the hospital bed and takes them to jail.
Fatou Camara is associate professor of law at Senegal's Cheikh Anta Diop University. She was speaking to Ricky Shryak from Dakar. It's coming up at 25 minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Hosts and Nigeria Super Falcons pipped Cameroon's indomitable Lionesses by a solitary goal in a friendly played in Abuja on Tuesday. In Egypt, the Democratic Republic of Congo's TP Mazembe and AS Vita, Egypt's Zamalek and Sudan's El Hilal are in Group A in the mini-league phase of the Orange Africa Champions League. According to the draws conducted in Cairo, Egypt on Tuesday, Group B features Tunisia's CS Sfaxien and Esperance, Libya's El Ahli Benghazi, and Algeria's Entente Setif. Staying in Cairo, Congo-Brazzaville's AC Leopards, Ivory Coast's ASEC Mimosa, Mali's AS Real de Bamako, and Cameroon's Cotton Sport are in Group A for the Orange Africa Confederations Cup mini-league. Group B includes Egypt's El Ahli, Ivory Coast's Sewe Sports, Tunisia's Etoile du Sahel, and Zambia's Nkana. In volleyball, Algeria's GS Petroleas dismissed defending champions Kenya Prisons in three straight sets to claim the Africa Women's Club Volleyball Trophy in the Tunisian capital, Tunis. Kenya Pipeline beat Tunisia's Carthage 3-1 to clinch the bronze medal. GS Petroleas will represent Africa at the World Women's Club Volleyball Championships in Zurich, Switzerland next week. In swimming, defending champions Kenya amassed 35 gold, 41 silver and 29 bronze medals to top the medal standing at the Kana Zone 3 and 4 Africa Junior Swimming Championships in Kampala, Uganda. South Africa is second, followed by Zambia, Angola, Mauritius, Uganda, Tanzania, Malawi, Burundi, Rwanda and the Seychelles. Turning to athletics, Nigeria's Africa Youth and Junior 200-meter champion Divine Oduduru clocked 21.14 seconds to win the 200 meters at the Athletics Federation of Nigeria Golden League meet in Ilorin, Kwara State, Southwest Nigeria. 18-year-old newfound Omeza Akere triumphed in the men's 400 meters in 47.33 seconds. On the infield, another junior athlete, Brume Ese, won the women's long jump with a leap of 6.40 meters as former Africa Junior champion Chime Nkechi won the women's shot put with a heave of 14.62 meters. Finally, world marathon champion Stephen Kiprotich was crowned the Nile Special Uganda Sports Press Association USPA 2013 Sports Personality of the Year in Kampala, Uganda. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a great day. Listener mail for this Wednesday morning comes from Mohamed Akme Masu of Monrovia, Liberia. He says, dear VOA, I think the prolonged crisis in South Sudan is due to the neglect of the African Union and the United Nations. Both organizations have failed to carry out their responsibilities. This is why I think both the South Sudan government and the rebels have not come together to reconcile their differences for the sake of peace. But I think the current talks in Ethiopia are a golden opportunity for both sides to once and for all end the carnage in South Sudan. We thank you, Mohamed Akme Masu of Monrovia, Liberia, for your comment. And please send your viewpoints to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. A powerful U.S. senator is blocking military aid to Egypt after it sentenced 683 Muslim Brotherhood members to death for their role in protest against the overthrow of President Mohamed Morsi. Democrat Patrick Leahy chairs the Senate subcommittee overseeing foreign aid. He said Tuesday he is not prepared to sign off on aid to Egypt until the U.S. sees convincing evidence that Egypt's government is committed to the rule of law. That's it for this Wednesday, April 30th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clutty and Ricky Stryak, as well as host editor Mark Ouma and our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Butter saying have a lovely day, Africa.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpuga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz, We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.
From Washington, this is VOA.